You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand. I am the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumental in supporting many of the programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read. The list is long, and the programs are vital in giving access and help to Angelenos across this vast city. This season, we're focusing on resilience, and we picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to how all of us have had to be resilient in order to survive these last 20 months. We've adjusted our lives in order to deal with the constant challenges, frustrations, and acute realities that we've had to face, our collective fear being one of them. Tonight, we're going to look at Louise Erdrich's wonderful novel, The Sentence. Erdrich faces our time head-on with a ghost story that looks at the living, the dead, and generations of racism against Black and Indigenous Americans, and the deep and abiding love of books. As the Washington Post wrote in their review, the coronavirus pandemic is still raging away, and God knows we'll be reading novels about it for years. But Louise Erdrich's The Sentence may be the best one we ever get. Neither a grim rehashing of the lockdown nor an apocalyptic exaggeration of the virus. Her book offers the kind of fresh reflection only time can facilitate, and yet it's so current, the ink feels wet. Louise Erdrich, a member of the Turtle Mountain Band, Erdrich is the author of many novels, as well as volumes of poetry, children's books, and a memoir of early motherhood. Her novel, The Roundhouse, won the National Book Award for Fiction. Love Medicine and La Rose received the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. Her last book, The Night Watchman, before she wrote The Sentence, won the Pulitzer Prize. Erdrich lives in Minnesota and is the owner of Birch Bark Books, a small independent bookstore that plays a part in The Sentence. Eric, she'll be in conversation with Eric Gainsworth, who is a writer and visual artist born and raised at the Tuscarora Nation. Gainsworth has written 12 books. He's also had numerous solo and group exhibitions. His work has received a Penn Oakland Award, an American Book Award, and the Prince Honor. Gainsworth's work has been supported by multiple and venerable institutions, including the Library of Congress, the Sultan Stahl, Lannan Foundation, and the New York Foundation for the Arts. I'm very proud and very thrilled to introduce both Louise Erdrich and Eric Gainsworth. Please welcome. Thank you both for being here, and my apology for not pronouncing that correctly. You're going to tell me how to pronounce it. Thank you.
thank you to Aloud and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles for allowing me to have this conversation with my friend Louise Erdrich about her new book. I'm so really excited. Even though I've just had a sneak peek to have read The Sentence before very many other people. So thank you, Louise, for inviting me to be involved in this conversation.
Eric, I've been looking forward to this so much. It can't imagine. I really have wanted to have to talk to you about books. I guess we could have just gotten on Zoom anytime and talked about books, but this gives us this wonderful opportunity to feel that we have to do it. So we're going to do it. And thank you all for tuning in, because this is going to be, as you can see by Eric's surroundings, a very fun conversation. My surroundings may be more muted, but they hide a wealth of chaos. And it's all up here too. So, and thank you to the LA Library Foundation, all the sponsors. I'm really so excited to talk. And it's Tuscarora, correct?
Correct, Tuscarora. I think probably my my ceremonial name is in my bio these days, and that may have thrown her off. So
it is. Oh, and also, so we can blame the fact that we have advanced readers' copies for anything, and that it's you know, we're all trying our best for anything. So whatever happens, but the Turtle Mountain Band should have of Chippewa on the end. And so that's because it was an advanced reader with a lot of mistakes still in it. And so I've just been adding of glam rock wherever I can. So I'm from the Turtle Mountain Band of glam rock. And I'm talking to Eric. Let's start talking about music, because there's music in both the books.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the things that goes on in when you fall into somebody else's world, is that you begin to see different overlaps that you didn't know were there. And in fact, now I kind of want to know, I'm going to ask this question because you've opened it up. So you have a quote in there from a song, but the song Hurt. So is it the Nine Inch Nails version or is it the Johnny Cash version?
Oh, I knew you'd get that. Yeah. So Tookie, our hero, who is prone to just do everything, including sing Hurt as a lullaby to her new grandson. It's Johnny's. Yeah. You can tell because there's a lot of Johnny Cash's in there a lot.
It's true. And I think that's the thing with this protagonist, Tookie. She seems like 100 women I've known my entire life. I mean, there's a very particular, not to generalize at all, but for whatever reason, Indian communities seem to allow or encourage the shaping of this personality of being a really tough survivor with a deeply sentimental core that she doesn't want to show anybody. And I'm trying to stay away from revealing anything about this book while we talk about it as well. Not that it's the sixth sense level of surprises, but the way it unfolds is so beautiful. I don't want to steal that from anybody.
Well, she is that way. And I didn't expect her to be the narrator at all. I'd started this book many, many times, and I started it originally in 2013 or 14. So I kept writing it every year, starting as an educated in Catholic schools and superstitious person on All Souls Day. Every year I'd start it again. And I finally, when I started it in 2019, decided I'm writing it straight through. I'm not gonna make any excuses for myself, no matter what happens. And then this sentence came to me. I knew the title was gonna be the sentence. Then I got this sentence: while in prison, I received a dictionary. So she unfurled from that first sentence, just her entire character and voice. And I was not happy about that first sentence, because this would mean I had to contend with incarceration. And I had worked in the prison system long, long ago, but I think, like a lot of people, I find it extremely painful to confront the truth of what's happening in our carceral system in the United States, right? So she says somewhere, for instance, that Minnesota incarcerates more people than all of Canada. Minnesota alone incarcerates more women than all of Canada, incarcerates more women than all of the European Union. So there was a lot to that sentence, and it became another sentence, just arose out of that, because I couldn't refuse a sentence like that. Do you know what I'm saying? A sentence comes to you.
I do. Yeah. And I think one of the it was really one of my central questions for you. And I know we're trying to, I never really get to ask you about your book at this time when they write around the release, because often if I do see you, it's in the middle of a very, very hectic period. But I right. guess one of the strange gifts of COVID is that there's a certain level of intimacy where you get to, you really do get to talk one-on-one with somebody, because all of those other parts of life have been kind of stripped away. And I was 19 when I read Love Medicine, and it had just come out, and I was beginning trying to write. I had a few horror short stories written, which were not very good. And my creative writing professor said, "You should read this book." He said, "It's a really beautiful book, and I think you'd like it no matter what. But it also is exploring some of the same things you're trying to articulate." Which I thought was so diplomatic, you know, that you're trying to articulate. So he's a very kind professor in that way, that I wasn't there, but he was nurturing me along anyway. And one of the things I noticed immediately about it was your mastery with titles, and how each title, the title of each chapter, was like a key to 5 to 10 different understandings of each chapter. And because I've taught it now for many years as well, I see new doorways to use those titles as keys for every time I walk in. And I saw that to be true here as well. It seems like a very direct title, the sentence, and yet the more I read, the more sentences I saw. And I wondered about how we understand that simple two-word construction, the sentence. It reminded me sort of the beginning of the Gulf War, when that phrase Operation Enduring Freedom was really popular. Right. And I thought, yeah, enduring freedom.
Right.
In America. And I just kept continuing to think about that a sentence in this book is very much something to survive.
It is. And in the book, there is someone who there are so many levels. It's about there's a sentence about survival. There's a sentence about being sentenced to live in the wrong skin, or what the other person wants. You know, there's so many levels of being sentenced in the book. And of course, then there's the world's most beautiful sentence. And I found myself continually collecting the world's most beautiful sentences. And there's a dictionary somewhere around here. Oh, here it is. So this dictionary is really the dictionary that, this is Tookie's dictionary. Tookie gets this dictionary from a teacher. But it's really my dictionary. I won this dictionary from the National Football League. Way back in the 70s, they had this contest where they gave either a college scholarship or one of 100 dictionaries. And I won a dictionary. But anyway, so sometimes she looks up a word, they're all from this dictionary, and then while she's incarcerated and receives this dictionary, the dictionary always gives sentences to, she looks up the word sentences, and in this dictionary, there is always a couple of examples of the word. So in this case, it's the word sentence, and she sees that the sentence examples are, the door is open, period, and go, period. And she says those are the most beautiful sentences in the English language. They become, there's all sorts of layers as I was saying, but we started talking about titles, and you also are a title master. So this book full of notes and this title, it's all through the book, because not only is it it's a nickname, it's a fruit, it's a beautiful visual, but it also is so much about the Beatles. This book is so great. So you have titles in the book that are Beatles songs, and I love that, because every so often I can't help myself, but I go to Star Trek Next Generation in one book where I used episodes from a year of Star Trek for the titles. And isn't it strange how they all fit when you get Yeah.
It's almost like a map of the gift relationship between writer and reader, that you can find this gift that somebody else gave you and maybe kind of rewrap it. I guess it's re-gifting. Maybe that's poor form, but to then sort of send it back out there in a slightly different version to allow people to see it fresh in some other way. And that's been kind of a delight of having the opportunity to have this career, is to kind of play with titles in that way.
Oh, I love how you said that. It's a delight. It is. And you know, no matter how serious things do get serious in this book, and yet it's been a delight to write it. I feel as though I'm every time I'm able to write in a and keep writing a book, I have that feeling as though I've got to be doing the luckiest form of work in the world. And it's it gets really impossible sometimes. Like, this had some impossible moments, but I do feel like it's, and I hope people can tell when they read this book that I was having a lot of fun writing Tookie. She saved me during this time. Her outlook was established before 2019. And I needed it during the pandemic.
She's been good company for it. Throughout the book, I would be reading, you know, just really enjoying myself, and then hit a sentence that made me stop in ways that were, I was sort of crying and laughing simultaneously, because it resonated so deeply with things that I knew. And often they were just casual exchanges between characters. And at one moment, Turkey says, I don't need your pain cake. it's kind of a surreal sentence, because it almost sounds like I don't need your pancake, but then this idea of a pain cake, and you know, there's a larger context, obviously, in your story about these two characters having this exchange. But I had to just stop and smile at that composition. It was just like it was a moment of grace in my day.
That's great, because this woman does not want to share her dessert, but then she comes around to it, right? And it's like something, and you can tell it hurts to share this dessert. So that's why I don't want to, I don't need your pain cake.
Right. And it's sort of that moment. It's that moment of begrudging generosity or begrudging friendship. I just really love, there are so many things happening in those few words.
A lot of these, I felt like I've been given a huge gift by having these daughters that I have, there is some basis of always joking around in our relationships, and always, and my family is my brothers. Oh my goodness, always we are always giving each other grief. And as you know, my sister Hyde, she's one of the funniest people. She is so funny, right? So
absolutely.
But this is part of, I sort of resist the idea of this as a, I didn't know what to do when I was confronted with the sorrows of this, of 2020. I didn't feel equal to them, and I probably was not equal to them, but being able to have Tookie take hold of what was happening, it made all the difference for me. And I think that's all I could do with the book. All I could do was follow the things that happened through these characters. And she just, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that she develops a romantic relationship with someone who in the beginning arrests her, because obviously she has to commit a crime in order to get into prison. Well, not obviously, many people don't commit crimes and they are in prison. But, and she receives a sentence of 60 years from a judge who believes in an afterlife, she says. And I thought at first when I wrote that was excessive, right? Even though I've been at trials where people got unbelievable sentences. But it's more common than I ever imagined once I started.
There are a number of highly unusual events at the beginning of this book, and yet they're told with a very casual sense of the matter-of-factness of a character who makes many not good decisions. And it's sort of accepting of that part of her life. That she's, she's like, I'm okay with that. And I know those people, and I've unfortunately been that person where I
probably the same with both of us.
Man, very questionable decisions.
Very questionable, very questionable. Yes, this is not like new territory.
Yeah, and if you are that person, you kind of have to accept it after a while, or you just stop moving. And I felt that it was really her voyage of moving forward, and in a way, the only way to represent 2020 in Minneapolis, I think, for many people, would be disingenuous to try and put her at the heart of everything in some kind of like Forrest Gump way. I mean, I think she experiences it in a way probably many people experience societal strife. You know, they're kind of simultaneously in the midst of it and at the edges of it.
Right. Right. And that's how she and, well, there's a number of, so then I can bring all the characters in and have them experience different aspects of it. But she, as a formerly incarcerated person, has a particular outlook on this. And that I didn't expect. It took me, gosh, I must have been writing it I was feverishly, it was like, feverishly, I don't want to say that. I was
probably not the year to say that.
I was desperately writing it, desperate to finish it in time, and I was, and she, I don't know. She did these things that kept surprising me even up to the very end. I didn't expect that she would then begin to see, you know, and this happened to so many families and different people, begin to question her relationship with her husband because policing came into this huge, huge, state of reckoning at that time and is still undergoing the state of reckoning. She had, that was very personal to her because of that romantic relationship with the man who arrests her.
I didn't necessarily want to take the cynical view of the title in that way, but in some ways, I mean, now that, you know, we're kind of there in our conversation, their marriage is in some ways partly a sentence, because it's a very complex marriage, and it's one that begins in the most fraught possible ways, in which he winds up arresting her and becoming the person who inadvertently delivers that sentence upon her.
Right.
So, you know, their origin is very funny. We've gotten a question here asking we're not transitioning into questions, but it applies to what we're talking about here, in that we've been asked if we discuss a little bit how we know one another, how we've come to know one another.
Oh my God.
So you've been sentenced with me for a while.
It was ordained by the gods that we would be sentenced to know each other. I admire Eric's work. Okay, so I'm a bookseller, and this is one of the most brilliant books about Indigenous identity that I know. And this is unbelievably wonderful. I know Eric that's a long way back. I have some of Eric's art, and also I've always loved is that you are inclusive. Your talent for visual art is just seamlessly interwoven with your work. I don't know how anyone does that. I don't know how I could do that. I've lost my words.
Well, I think thank you so much. I'm kind of speechless here. I'm trying not to be speechless. Beyond being an extremely modest bookseller, amazing award-winning national treasure, Louise is a member of a really generous community of Indigenous people who are also really talented. And I think I met first our mutual friend Mark Turcotte. He and I were being published by the same university press at the time, and then he introduced me to your sister Hyde, and Hyde and I have been we have incredibly close senses of humor, and so we talk a lot.
You do.
Probably more than I talk to most people in the world. We probably talk on the phone 4 times a week easily.
I didn't even know it was that often.
It's fairly often.
Oh, that's so okay. Now I'm gonna expect more. I can say how find out how you are all the time, but yeah. So.
And I think in that first year Hyde and I met, she was working at St. Thomas and invited me to give a reading for the series there. Right. And Birchbark Books had already become like this kind of a hot spot for writers to want to go to. It's a bookstore that, you know, if you know about bookstores, even that back then, so that would have been 2004, you want to go to Birchbark Books. And so that was one of the first things we did when I got to town. And
I didn't know that.
And you were in, I guess, at the time, and that's when we met. So, and we've kind of, I've gone back and forth to Minneapolis, and both of you and Hyde have been here in Western New York. So it's been a long time.
It has. It has been a long time.
Doesn't seem like it though.
But it seems like there's just so much richness in having known you, and I realize we haven't, like, you know, we don't go on trips together. I don't know if you've gone on trips with Hyde. I feel like you have.
Yeah, we've shared, we've been, what did we call it, conference spouses for AWP. We've shared a suite.
Conference spouses. Oh my gosh.
I hope that's a real thing and not something I'm making up.
Real thing, but it's not the way you guys are conference spouses.
Right.
You know, I just sometimes wonder, you know, when we're reading books, like Tookie starts reading what she calls murderous attention, right? She reads to get herself through being incarcerated. And thereafter reads books, and she kind of looks at them and she can always see the underpinnings of the book, all of the scaffolding underneath it, right? And I'm wondering, as a writer, do you read books like that, or do you allow yourself to get lost in them?
I fairly often don't take on a new book because I immerse myself in a book and I read them multiple times. And so when I take on a new book, I know I'm going to be living with it for a while.
Yeah.
And so I love the pleasure of falling into the story for the first time and not knowing where it's going. And I mean, I'm not a big spoiler obsessive. If somebody tells me the end, fine. I mean, it's not really, I don't really care. I'm there for the entire journey. But then I start asking all kinds of questions on the second reading. Like, I've noticed in the sentence for about 20 pages at different points, you switch briefly to third person narratives. And I kept asking myself, is that too nerdy and writerly a question to ask? But I'm asking, how does that happen in a book that's so very Tookie immersive for the rest of its course?
Well, so for instance, all right, I'll just give this, so for instance, she has, they have a daughter, although she's the daughter of her Pollux's brother. Tookie's married to Pollux. So, but this is typical. She's their daughter. And she and Tookie are vehemently opposed to each other all up until something happens anyway.
Right. But
I had to have something happen to this daughter that would be part of something for Tookie to help solve, to help with, right? And for somebody else to help with. So she had to have a backstory of sorts. And I don't know why, but I'd already written this part about taking Greyhound buses. And then I gave Pollux the idea that he'd seen Kim Basinger, and on the bus, and that she was going to be in a movie called Midnight Cowgirl, and she was doing research. I don't know, this is going to sound too crazy. So nobody's going to want to read this book. It gets like, there's so many things in it like this. But then later on, we find out that all these little hints that are dropped in the beginning about the daughter turning down a movie turn out to be false. And she really did take this movie, and it is Midnight Cowgirl. But it's not a movie that will play in, family-oriented theaters, let's just say.
Right.
It's only going to be playing in those kind of warehouse-type barn places out. I don't know, that's where in Minnesota they played. but they play, of course, online all the time. But
right.
Anyway, so she stars in that. And how are we going to get her out of what's happening to her? Because this was a huge mistake.
And beautifully, intricately structured as well. And I thought, I think the part I love the most about that little through line that keeps kind of showing up throughout the book is that I kind of feel like nobody believes Pollux when he says he runs into Kim Basinger on the Greyhound. I mean, and why would you? Why would you believe that story?
Nobody
calls him on it either. They sort of allow him to have that fantasy.
Yeah. And you know, what happens to this daughter is totally understandable. She doesn't really know what she's getting herself into.
Right.
It happens all the time. Nobody, you don't know that you're what you're getting into. And so then we know that this, that he really must have seen her and this was a serious thing. But I mean, it becomes a way of bringing two people together in the end. I don't know. So that's all a very long way of saying, this is why I have the third person sometimes, because this is the problem of a first person narrator. And, you know, they're always like listening in on other conversations so that you can, or they're overhearing something happening from below through the transom, or, you know, and you can't have that all the time. Every so often, you just have to let go and give the voice to another character.
Right.
Without explanation. That's what I decided to do, because I couldn't have too much of that overhearing stuff happening.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that was one of the true gifts of Love Medicine for me, was I didn't know as I was working, you know, I come from really, my reservation is very small. It's like 5 miles by 7 miles. So it's 1,000 people. We all, you know, and I probably don't know everybody anymore because I don't know the kids, but I know all the families and they all know me. And when I wanted to become a writer and that I knew I was going to finally be writing about this, I couldn't really tell a singular first person story at the time, because I thought in community, and that's what Love Medicine allowed me to see, was the possibility of multiple narrators who were each carrying a piece of the story. And I thought, oh, well, that's what I can do.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Thank you.
It was tremendously freeing because of that very question. I just felt like I couldn't, it did not seem like I could write an American novel in the way that I understood American novels to be.
Yeah.
And Love Medicine came to the rescue.
Well, I hardly ever, I guess I never really sustained a first person narration until The Roundhouse, I think, was the first one. But once it happened, I got to really hope I'd find another one. And you just do these things by keeping the door open. You never know when you're going to get a sentence, a title, a character, right? You just have to hope that it comes to you. And I think Tookie has been one of the ones I've loved writing in quite the most. Yeah.
If I Ever Get Out of Here was my first, so it took quite some time as well.
Yeah. And then once you are in a character, you get drawn along almost in spite of yourself into different pieces of the narrative that you, like, I didn't read about the crime in the beginning. I had no format in my head. I didn't know what was going to happen, but she just kept doing things. And she kept making things worse and worse for herself. So in a way, the problem of the book was for her to stop doing that. But then how do you keep the narrative going after that? When someone, you know, decides to work in a bookstore, she can't keep committing crimes at the level that she was. Or maybe
she can be flirtatious with it, clearly.
She really considered a lot of crimes.
Right. And that seemed true. That I think that was something I really understood about her character immediately, was she, and I think that happens with a lot of people who are formerly incarcerated, you know, as they want to start off on this other path, but they know this one in particular so well that it's the first thing they think of. And so to see her kind of struggling with that early on in the book, was, it felt very true. She felt like people I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it was interesting because the bookstore then became involved with the Women's Prison Book Project. After this, I was looking around. Hyde is involved with the Minnesota Women's Prison Writing Project, but this book project is great too. It is to collect books to send to women in prison. And I felt like I was thanking Tookie in a way, because I didn't know that this existed and I found out about it, and the bookstore is able to send books out to women through this project, which is based in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. So it's something worth looking up if anybody is interested, Women's Prison Book Project.
And I think that's one of the other lovely things about choosing to set it here is I have, in this area, there are several very meaningful independent bookstores in my life. You know, there's Talking Leaves in Buffalo, which is, you know, kind of people know nationally, and there's the Book Corner in Niagara Falls. And there was another one in Niagara Falls, which is run by this deeply eccentric British couple, and you could barely tell it was a bookstore, and it was just packed. You know, it was really more like a hoarder store, and you could go and visit and maybe buy a book every now and then. But I found some great things there, and they were super fascinating people to meet and talk to. I think they showed me that you could be a book person.
Yes.
And that's something that an independent bookstore with its own identity can do for people who love books, and that Amazon can't, or that Barnes & Noble can't.
No, there's no way, because I mean, one of the many reasons is because when you get an algorithm driving you, your interests, sort of sucking your interests out of what you already read and then giving you your interests, it's not the same as going in a bookstore and being confronted by book after book after book. Nor is it anywhere near the same as talking to a person who read the books. The algorithm cannot read the book and cannot talk to you about the book.
And right.
That's from the beginning. That was, besides wanting to be a native source bookstore, we were general bookstore as well, but and really loving the native community here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I wanted to try and exist in that very precarious spot, which was where Amazon had suddenly taken over taking over the information of so many people and through books. And I wanted to step in and see if we could have a tiny place that would be kind of eccentric and full of personality, and just for us to be whatever we are. I wanted that so badly, and we still are the same, but what's crazy is that people have discovered that they can buy any books online from any small bookstore. So there's indie bookstores and
right.
And so I keep encouraging people to walk to their nearest store if they can, or drive to go in person, so that you will be confronted with books you didn't think about. Because it's like opening a cloth-bound dictionary, right? You never know what words you're going to come across, who you're going to find in a bookstore.
And I think that's one of the more marvelous moments in this book, is when the characters are, you know, are saying something quite literally, but then saying this much larger thing. And when the your avatar, I suppose, the Louise character in the book, is delighted to discover that the bookstore is labeled as essential, that bookstores are essential businesses. You know, it has very specific meaning for the book because it's in the middle of COVID, but it means something else just about the survival of literate culture, period. And I really loved the way it resonated like a tuning fork for this whole book and for the experience of being a reader.
It meant so much to me personally, because we were among the first business. I was so proud of it. Like, okay, Minnesota deemed us essential right away. And of course we were a store. Stores were mostly allowed to stay open, you know, and go online, but stay open. But it meant so much to me. And then that customers called up and asked for books that we would then put out on the curbside. You know, we had curbside pickup. That was so meaningful too. And I think that's the way, there's something so wonderfully human about the relationship between people and bookstores and books. And I really see books as one of the most basic forms of technology that we have. It's a technology just as important, you know, as what do they call that? Ur-technology.
Right.
The right. Human technology would be spoon, fork, knife, or just maybe knife, or maybe just spoon. And I put book in with the ur-technology. I mean, you know, I mean, like, oh, you know, and a cloak and some shoes, whatever, you know, is just the most important pieces of that you have to have.
Oh, and it looks like that's our first question ties right into that.
We're into question time.
Yeah, apparently we are. Jan asks, how much of the bookstore in the novel reflects your bookstore and your bookstore experience?
Well, I tried not to say exactly that it is the bookstore, because I didn't want people who were working, my co-workers at the bookstore, I didn't want to have them have to answer questions like, are you in the book? Who were you, this person in the book, right?
Sure.
So I was trying to stop that from happening, but you know, it was kind of obvious that I had to base it on experience with a bookstore, and that is the experience I've had. Also, it was always a little spooky to me, that place. Always a little spooky. But also at night, I find that there's this sense of all of these different, I mean, I feel like there's all this consciousness in the bookstore, and that it is contained, and that somehow it's maybe seeping out of the pages. It's in the air. Yeah, I love going in there, but it's also kind of spooky.
I can kind of see that. When we've been there for events, sometimes later in the evening, it seems like a different place once the audience is gone and we're just kind of, you know, there alone. Bill asks, when you were writing this book, did you think of it as a ghost story? And were you inspired by any particular ghost stories or fiction while you were writing it? I kind of want to know this myself.
Oh, it was always a ghost story. I always wanted to write the haunted bookstore. You know, I always wanted to write a ghost story. God, that's a good question about what these books were definitely influencing this book. Well, there's a book list at the end that's called the Ghost Managing Book List. And those books really influenced. This summer, I read The Hattuck Witches by Devin Mihasua, and I was blown away by this book, Devin Mihasua, and it's called The Hattuck Witches, and she touched on some of the same tropes and, you know, the same haunted ground sort of tropes, and the same museum and human remains and all of those factual things about American culture and history. And so I devoured that book right up. I mean, I ate it right up. You can't say I devoured that book right up. or you can. Anyway, so that was really, it was important to me. I was almost done with the writing of the book, but when I read her book, I thought, God, this really can be done. It's much more compulsive reading. I could not stop and put that book down for a second.
I think when I was reading, I wanted to say when I was working on this, but obviously I was not. when I was reading this, it occurred to me that I'm often making fun of the way in which indigenous ghosts show up in American popular culture. There's always a burial ground somewhere that's causing havoc everywhere. It's in The Shining, it's in Poltergeist. And yet the ghost that exists here is much more matter of fact in the way in which I see indigenous cultures, people I know, friends I know, kind of referring to the unseen in a much more matter of fact way. Like its sensibility seemed true to me. It seemed to be the world that I knew.
It's also turning everything on its head by indigenous people being haunted by European descendants and settler descendants. It's the opposite of what the trope usually has been.
Right.
We've put that trope to rest.
And we haven't really talked about that character. Flora is a really complex person here, and it seems like it would be so easy to make her a caricature instead. And I'm wondering, was that a wrestling match to kind of really understand? Because obviously, if you're an indigenous person, you have met somebody who says, "Oh, I am so and so," and they have some very long, convoluted story about their ancestors.
Right. I don't think it's giving any ways a way to say, because you find out in practically the next sentence that she is was a wannabe, somebody who was always trying to get close to indigenous people, trying to get close to native people, and then took on the identity at last in the best way she could, although it wasn't really her own identity. But she also is a good person in so many ways.
Right.
Make her somehow a bad person. It makes her a terribly needy person, but that's what I feel like ghosts always are. So that's why it resonated for me. I always feel like ghosts are not malevolent, or I think that's also reflected in indigenous, in just tribal ways of seeing ghosts. Is that what I've always heard is like, hey, just see what they need. You try and give them something to eat. Try to give them something to eat, man. They probably are. Looking for some, and they're not like dangerous, but this ghost becomes, this ghost starts to manifest, so maybe becomes more active.
Right. Which seems to happen with people who start adopting that identity as well, and in real life even.
Oh my gosh, you're right. I never thought of that. Never thought of that. It's so true. Because then you cannot let it go. Yeah.
Right. Once they've invested in the identity, then they kind of can't say, well, maybe that's not me after all.
It's very hard to, but I find a lot of grace in people who have said that, yeah, that I think I was wrong. I found that's a very graceful thing to do.
It looks like we have another question. Are there other genres you would like to explore in your work? And you've been exploring genre for a little while now, much more than I have.
Well, I'm resisting the word genre here. We don't need genre. I guess I did use genre. Because I did, it's a ghost story. But maybe we can resist genre and just say whatever we write is, it always is going to owe something to another writer. It's always going to owe many writers and many forms of art, everything we do. But I feel like I've gotten to a situation where I couldn't really call this a ghost story after I finished it. And I couldn't really call it, you know, I wanted to write a ghost story, but it became very different from a ghost story. And that always happens when you try to write, you know, for instance, I really love this Colson Whitehead book, The Harlem Shuffle. And he said something about, like, I always wanted to write a heist book. I love heist books and heist movies too, but this is so much more. It's so much different than what you would say is a heist book. And I think the difference is that if you're a writer who always writes character first, that you can't stick to a formula.
And that seems to be something he explores fairly often. I mean, I recall when he wrote a zombie novel about a decade ago, people were shocked. They were saying, why are you, a literary writer in America, working on a zombie novel? And he just said, well, why not?
Why not? I mean, I think that's the freedom that you have. You don't. And I sort of resisted this idea. I got to the, you know, I can't really say this, but this would give everything away. One thing I like the most about writing is creating a certain kind of suspense in the writing. It's not continual. It's not like a you know, compulsive kind of thing. Like, I get into some books that I am compelled to keep reading, and I end up both loving them and slightly resenting them because they didn't let me sleep.
I have the same relationship. I really hate a successful page turner because then I'm no longer in control.
So I just want enough suspense to keep you going back.
Right.
Not enough suspense to be really upsettingly. And then when you get over it so fast, it's like, oh, God, it's gone now. You know.
It looks like we have one last question, then we'll welcome Jessica back at the end. This is kind of a lengthy question.
Oh, okay.
Hearing you both speak, I'm curious about what is inspiring you in your work looking forward, the unique perspective the book provides on the past year or two helped me understand this past year in a new light. I'm wondering what themes you see as driving you forward after a project like this. I guess it's the short version is, what's next, Louise?
What's next, Eric? I'm asking you. All right, let's just do the 10 word answer to that.
Okay, I have a book coming out next fall. I don't know if I can say the name of it yet, but it will be coming out next fall, and it's a coming of age novel.
Oh, good. Good.
Set in the 80s.
Oh, okay. I'm all in. I'm all in. Because I know there's going to be music in it. And you have somewhere where you talk about what you were listening to in the 80s. And I'm really excited. Okay. I'm in. I have several things I'm working on. And I'm always doing this where I work on several and I don't know which one is going to gather the weight that it needs. So I I can't really say. I wish I had something. I don't have something coming out soon, except, I did work on a young adult novel that will come out someday. it's almost getting finished, but it's part of this Birchbark House series.
Oh.
And some teachers asked me kind of to skip forward with the age. So maybe it's more like an older middle reader. I don't know what the exact designation would be, but it's a little bit more mature than the previous books in the series because the kids age out of those books.
Sure.
And then the teacher wants to give them something. I'm just writing it because I thought that made a lot of sense. But then I think I'm going to go right back to writing for middle readers. I think that's where I fit most. comfortably for children. You can have some destruction, some sorrow, but overall, you don't want to overwhelm a child. You really want to give the world a big chance. And then when you get teenagers, man, that's sometimes all they want. Right. I know my daughters have wanted magic and a lot of otherworldly things to happen, and then dystopias, exciting dystopias, and then being forced to be in these situations.
Right. All right.
No, well, shall we? That was too long. We were over our time. All right.
If people want to stick around, they can.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. I am so happy we got to talk. And
absolutely.
I really love talking to you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing the immensity of this tiny world that is behind you.
It was a blast. It was truly wonderful. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you both so much. And thank you for sort of also just filling out parts of my introduction as I write you in like our little chat. It was lovely. I want you to both keep writing. I wish I was like a young adult and could read these books that are coming up from Eric and perhaps from Louise soon, whenever it is. But thank you. And it's been a wonderful conversation, and hearing you both has been a joy. You were so comfortable sort of just chatting. It was like we were all eavesdropping in on a dinner party conversation for an hour. It was wonderful. Thank you all for being here. We have an event on the 2nd, a food event that we're very excited about, with a lot of wonderful chefs discussing sort of culture and food and the connection between their cultures and the food that they prepare. And thank you all for being here. And thank you, Louise and Eric, so much. And happy holidays. And take care of yourselves.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.